Well, this morning we're turning to a very different subject from yesterday, but again it's exploratory. It's again looking at foundations because we are exploring the roots of Christian life and behavior. And so one of the things that we're going to look at this morning is what place is there in myth within Christian consciousness? And actually, I should have made reference to it earlier, but there's an interesting article by Eric Kahler, K-A-H-L-E-R, and he has a series of essays called Out of the Labyrinth. These essays are, again, exploratory of different aspects of Christian faith, but he has a very interesting article called The Persistence of Myth. And you may well ask, what place is there for the persistence of myth in the Christian life? So perhaps the best way, as Kayla does, is to explore the meaning of myth. And it does, in fact, come from the Greek word mythos, which is perhaps one of the most elemental animal sounds we have, which is moo. It's the moo of the cow. In other words, that which is primordially inarticulate, like the growl of a beast, or the lowing of cattle, or the murmuring, as we have in the French, of the bee. So it's muted. It's a muttering that we're dealing with. But, of course, a much more specialized development of the word has taken place through Greek thinking. And so one other element that we find of the assumption of what is mythic is that which is given. We don't invent it. It lands on our plate, in our consciousness, or indeed our unconsciousness. So the whole enterprise that the Greek world entered into was an attempt to rationalize the myth. And so there's a real, if you like, a tension between mythos and logos. Expliciting the myth, interpreting it, talking about it. Now, of course, one of the tensions that we're living with in the modern world is, are we explaining it all away? Can we over-rationalize the myth? And so it's because of that situation that we're facing today that we realize that, just as Pascal could say, the heart has its reasons that reason knows not of. So we often hear simple Christians saying it's more felt than telt. There's a much deeper level to truth than simply loquaciously and rationalistically describing it all away. And in this context, we also want to look this morning at tragedy. Because this certainly, in the dark side of our life, is also one of the deepest components that the human being faces. And yet, as we see here, tragedy is not a biblical notion. You look up a Bible dictionary like the InterVarsity one or Zondervan's or some of the later ones, it just doesn't exist. Except one or two perhaps more daring, more recent ones will tell you that the only reason for talking about tragedy in the Christian life is because we do all have to face death. And so, of course, there's this close association between the inevitability of death, that is a tragedy for the human condition. So as Ecclesiastes reminds us, it comes to us all. But, of course, there's a difference of attitude between shivering with fear about its inevitability, its fatefulness, and how we then should live, as the scripture is obviously giving us a different stance. Again, the word fate is not a biblical word, because of the sovereignty of God, because of his kingship. Nothing is more impressive in the Old Testament than the kingship of Yahweh. It's that which gives the spontaneity for praise. Worship in the Old Testament is fundamentally elicited from the kingship of God, that he does all things well, that he's on the throne. And so Zion and all the symbolism of Zion is so closely tied up with sovereignty, God's sovereignty, and praisefulness from the human heart. So the view that Scripture gives to us then is that man's life is in God's hands, but they're good hands. He does all things well. So the notion of an inscrutable and impersonal fate isn't in the mindset of the Christian, of biblical man. There is still the tension of theodicy. There's still this Hume's fork business of Strypod, that how can you square logically the goodness of God with the sovereignty of God and with the reality of evil. Something goes, has to give way if you squeeze too hard. Try and make it too logical an explanation. So you're always finding that one of the feet of the tripod is crushed in your argument. So there is that problem, there is that real tension. But even again, the existence of evil, the calamitous events that may happen, while we can't explain them, they also become a summons to repentance. So, the reason why this morning we want to look at tragedy, which is not in the Bible, is because tragedy is all around us in the non-biblical world. And it certainly was for the early Christians in the Greek world. And it's especially, of course, in Greek drama, and it's significantly that it should be Greek drama, that it's most expressed. I suggest the reason why it has to be dramatic is because it's intolerable to talk about and to investigate and to systematize, because you try and do that and you get destroyed. So it's a spectacle. And the audience is moved to tears, anguish, pity. It's not explained. It just has to be taken. And of course there are human responses, but they're all profoundly mournful. And what lies, of course, at the heart of tragedy is the evil intent of those divine beings that have responsibility for all of this. The intolerableness is that the gods are evil in their intent for man. And so the components of tragedy are that there is this infinite power that is inscrutably expressed with evil intent, and all the heroism of man, or indeed all the attempt to express goodness. Good motive is all crushed. But what heightens the drama is that man is blind. He doesn't know what's going on behind the scenes. We have a certain inkling of this, of course, in Job's situation. Job didn't know what was going on in this divine council, or the discussion between the adversary and Yahweh. In fact, it's not Yahweh who seems to be there, it's Elohim, the sort of chairman of the divine council. And so there is a blindness that Job has. So there's that Greek hint that we have there. Though, of course, the outcome is very different from Greek tragedy. And so this destruction of man, in spite of his heroic best, is that moment of tragedy when he smells freedom, but it's a very brief freedom, and then the juggernaut comes along and crushes him and exterminates the whole situation. Well, why should the gods be evil? Because there's a principle back of that lies in the ancient world. And that is the coexistence of good and evil. And in fact, if you look at the creation myths of the ancient world in Sumeria, it's obvious that the primordial principle is evil. In the beginning, there was chaos. And creation is really the triumph of the good over the chaos. That's why, as you have been, some of you, listening to Dr. Bockmuhl, no doubt, in his course in Genesis, come up with this triumphant basic presupposition that in the beginning there was not evil. In the beginning was God. And in the beginning was that word that was communicated to stand the reality of chaos. So that, again, we do have a hint that that which was tohu bohu, that which was formless and void, which is a dual expression of the chaotic, was overcome. And in a double way, in the first 3 days, that which was formless was given form, that which was empty was in days 4, 5, and 6 given population. So there is a wonderful polemic against this primordial principle that was assumed, the principle of evil. And this is, of course, elaborated later in Greek mythology, where it's now Zeus himself who is the evil messenger, the evil source. Though there's uncertainty, because though he is evil, and what he does to so many is also associated with an impersonal reality of the fates of Moira. But you see, again, this is something that's a spectacle. So if you're going to argue about it, talk about it, rationalize about it, then when the moralists begin to do so, they've got to soften it. And so they begin to interpret Moira as punishment for pride, for arrogance, human arrogance. And so this cycle of success begetting the desire for more, and so greed begetting complacence, and complacence begetting arrogance, is a familiar theme among the tragedians. fact, it's only this way that evil can be given any descriptive or rationalized form. But in the true spectacle of tragedy, these are the elements that we have. The blindness of man that is sent by the gods, the spirits between infinite power and human finitude, the demon, the lot, the fate in which man is cast, the jealousy of the gods, and this whole dilemma of human immoderation. So these dialectics that are operating of fate and freedom are the essential ingredients then for what is tragic. As we say, in summary form here, hostile transcendence operates against finite resistance. And of course, in such classic myths as Oedipus, who, to the shock of the audience, doesn't know what's happening right to the last minute of that revelation of really what has taken place incestuously in the family history, or the situation of Prometheus, who, in a sense, in a certain goodness, is wanting to give man that vital basic need of fire for domesticity and culture, that which is so vital for anything that man can have of either a cultural development or a technological development, is again doomed. So look at this first significant contrast between tragedy and God's sovereignty. It's in tragedy you can only have a spectacle. It's in God's gracious sovereignty that we can afford contemplation. And so these are primordial contrasts between the non-Christian assumptions and the biblical revelation. And so as we say here that it was impossible for the tragedians to explicit the formulation of what we might call tragic theology, because inevitably it would mean the very self-destruction of religious consciousness. The thing that is so ultimately intolerable is that the gods themselves are evil. Then there's nothing but chaos. All life comes to an end then. And so, therefore, instead, the only permissible response is the impotence of emotion, and pity, where there's no redemption. And so, we well know, whether we look in the East, in India, where this is obviously very much more intensified in the cyclicity of the myths, or indeed in the West, in Greece. The only hope is that eventually time may wear out the claws and teeth of the wrath of the gods and men. That's all there is. Even if it's the feather of an eagle that brushes the Himalayas, and denudes them of their content. So there's no final end. Man is caught up in the eternal return. The ways in which such a world sought to obviate these intrinsic tensions was either by a religion of divine possession, that is to say, the one hope might be that mankind might be consorting with the gods, taken up by the gods. And of course, this is an echo that we have of temple prostitution. Or else, in Bacchanalian, Dionysian frenzy, in drunkenness, divine ecstasy, in that sense. And it's significant that in these primal passages in Genesis 1 to 11, that both of these things are indeed indicted. That in Genesis chapter 6, when the daughters of men take up with the sons of God, where there is this attempt of divine possession, there is this indictment against that practice of temple prostitution. Or again, in the story of Noah, his own drunkenness and its exposure and shame and its consequences are fully declared. So, the biblical perspective is that the solutions for the tensions of life are not to be found in either of these directions. Another element that we find that is deep within the mythic consciousness of man is the cyclicity of nature. So another category of myths that we have in the ancient world are the myths of the eternal return in the field of cosmogony, in the origin of things. And there are two elements that are worth noting. One is that nothing on earth is intrinsic in itself. It's reflected in a heavenly archetype, celestial archetype. That these determine everything. So every ritual, every location of a sacred site or a temple or city, the centering of sanctity, all of these things are really archetypal in their structuring, in their ordering. As some of the texts say, we must do what the gods did at the beginning. Thus the gods did, this men do too. But it's not a relational doing, it's the doing of magic. It's the doing of ritual. It's all done in this impersonal prescriptive form because you cannot move back beyond the primordial archetypal realities. And all that man can do then in the context of this is simply to repeat these exemplary and paradigmatic gestures ad infinitum. So, one thing that was obviously apparent in the biblical world was the New Year festivals celebrated in the spring with the beginning of the rains. The renewal of creation was celebrated, the re-enthronement of kingship. And of course, we find such a contrast in the echo of the Psalms that thy kingdom or thy kingship or thy throne is established forever and ever. No repetition. No insecurity. No instability. The whole fabric of consciousness is contrasted, profoundly so. But, of course, in that primordial mythic consciousness of the ancient world, everything had to begin again. I mean, the frenzy of diplomacy all started all over again. Treaties that were made between states all had to take place after the re-enthronement. And time, too, was interpreted cyclically. So that there is no history. There is no linear progression. Everything is the cycle. And so, again, Genesis 1 to 11 is a polemic against all of this mindset. Creation is a final reality. God saw that it was good, and it's all concluded. So he rests on the seventh day. The eternal rest of the finality of what God in his sovereignty brings forth. And even when there's catastrophe, cataclysm, as the flood represents, the flood of Genesis is very different from the flood of Mesopotamia in its story and in its message. Again, the fall, the entrance of sin in its eventfulness is a reality that has been eventful. It's not a notion. It is occurred in the historical reality of man's own existence. Though archetypally, each one of us puts our place in the place of Adam and of Eve. Each one of us has that awareness of the implication of separation from God. Consequently, each of us has our responsibility. As one text of the 3rd century AD puts it quite poignantly, Adam therefore is not the cause, save only of his own soul. But each of us has been the Adam of his own soul. And we can apply that to our family history. Nowadays, as we hear more about the way in which we've inherited all our emotional problems, and we carry all this psychic baggage of sickness and neurosis, who are to blame, our parents or ourselves? The inheritance certainly is something that we're not to blame for, but we're certainly responsible for how we respond. As one writer has observed, I think very poignantly, if 95% of my emotional behavior is attributed to my parental history, then it means I'm only 5% alive. That we can't blame our heritage. We can't blame Adam, for that matter. So these are some of the polemics that we find that are given to us. One of the amazing things that is happening today in the postmodern world is the way in which this mythic consciousness seems to have erupted back into our society. We thought all these myths were finished with. And now we find, especially through the feminist movement to begin with, but in other ways as well, that there's this whole postmodern quest for sacred psychology. What sacred psychology is the unabashed intrusion of paganism into the contemporary mind. I'm sorry that she carries the same name, but Jean Houston, in her book, The Search for the Beloved, is speaking unabashedly of the return of paganism into modern consciousness. And so this is why we as Christians face a new generation where this whole realm of mythic consciousness is taking new face, new importance. A husband and wife team write a book called The Goddess Within, A Guide to the Eternal Myths That Shape Women's Lives. And unabashedly, the psychic traits that we want to emulate or the emotional experiences that we want to have archetypal authority for in our own lives are in fact the embracing, unabashedly so, of the Greek goddesses. We can't turn our back on these things and say nonsense. They are nonsense. But it's a nonsense that many people are obviously lapping up. We have a bookstore here, Bantam Bookstore, and it has the hottest clientele in terms of numbers and the sales of all this New Age stuff, which is exceeding now, I would think, the sales of any of the traditional bookstores. And the traditional bookstores themselves are being forced into all of this. So, where do we as Christians find literature, find encouragement to edify our own sublimable life? It's woefully absent in our evangelical culture. And when we look at C.S. Lewis's mythic novel, Till We Have Faces, it's one of the very rare examples, isn't it, of an attempt, a very creative attempt, to give a Christian perspective on this primordial consciousness of the mythic world. Actually, this female character, the daughter of the king that becomes the queen, as you read the story, it suddenly hits you that it's C.S. Lewis describing himself. It's autobiographical. And he is, of course, exploring this basic theme that fallen man cannot know himself. In other words, the theme that we've seen is so central to Greek tragedy is that it's a tragedy of man's blindness. Now, the Greeks had no understanding of how that blindness was related to sin. They thought that blindness was imposed upon them by the fickleness of the gods. But Lewis traces this blindness. And so Orwell is struggling for a different life, and so she writes her story of anguish and tragedy as an indictment against the gods, and she's complaining bitterly that they don't hear her complaints. It's interesting that early on in her life, there's the death of her mother, like Lewis himself experienced. He tells us that when his mother died at the age of 10, it was as if the continent of Atlantis, with all its security, had disappeared under the waves. Just a few islets were left in the darkness of the primordial sea. So Oriole has this devastating loss of security in her life. And as the Oxford Don sought his identity, but actually lost his identity behind his profession, so Oriole, becoming queen, loses her identity. And so we're told on page 226 that the queen of Gloam that she had become had more and more part in me, and Orwell had less and less. I locked up Orwell, or laid her asleep as best I could, somewhere deep down inside me. It was like being with child, but reversed. The thing I carried in me grew slowly smaller and less alive. What a profound statement. We all carry the child within us. Child of our past. And there's an authentic child. It's that child of God that God intends us to be, but it's wounded. It cries out. Can we listen to it? Oriel's experience was that she denied its existence. She, in a sense, was totally caught up in the functionalism of being queen, the status of being queen. I sometimes watch some of my own friends who have, in different parts of the world, become Christian leaders, and so often they stop being normal human beings. They become politicians, and you know you didn't trust them, and you know that they'll never expose themselves because they've adopted this queenship or this kingship. And so the Queen of Gloam became more and more, and the real self became less and less. It's interesting that Lewis is referring to the fact that she gained strength from two realities. She had two counselors. Lysias was called the fox, but he was pretty loyal to her, but he was essentially the rationalist. And no doubt what Lewis is referring to is the rational side of himself that was first of all stimulated by a tutor that he had in his late teens, who was an atheist actually, and influenced him to become an atheist. And there was the warrior who was faithfully protecting him. And when you think about it, the way we live is so to develop around us that rationalistic interpretation of everything. That's our self-defense. And of course, we have other defenses that we use to guard ourselves as well. So she had these two companions, but she also had a veil, and this veil she then began to wear habitually, a veil with which to hide her ugliness, the veil she never took off. And of course, this was, as we've seen, what the Greeks thought all that the persona was, all that the person was. It was a mask that one wore as one strutted on the stage. For if you stripped off the veil, you would find emptiness. Find she didn't have a face. There was nothing there. Of course, this is the whole thrust of the book, till we have faces. We haven't got it. Who am I? Who do I really want to be? Why don't I have an identity? And with speculation about who she really was, I became something very mysterious and awful. She did have another companion. It was her half-sister Psyche. Psyche represents the soul by the very name and refers to that positive influence in her life for good and for love and for true relationship. But Psyche was demanded by the high priest to be sacrificed and destroyed. And so she's taken from her. And this is her tragedy. They gave me nothing in the world to love but Psyche. And then he took her away from me. We were tracing in our first lecture, somewhat stumblingly, about the diminution of the soul of modern man and the rise of the Enlightenment thinking. And so, in a sense, Lewis is portraying that reality. What is significant is that Lewis is telling us to do something here that the Queen does, which helps us all. She writes all her complaints in a book. It's a very helpful thing for us to keep a journal. Or if we can't keep a journal, at least we write a letter to someone that really bugs us. Someone that really stands in the progress of our spiritual growth. And it may be we can't send a letter, but at least we keep it. And it helps to articulate and bring to the surface things that we had no idea of. And so what she finds is that the very act of writing, and we all go through this experience, you know, we say this, write out what you feel about your emotional life. Oh, I have nothing to talk about. There's nothing I can say. No sooner do you start writing than it all pours out. And so Lewis tells us that Oriel, in the very act of writing, becomes drenched with seeings. All these insights begin to pour out. And then in dreams and visions and various circumstances, she's now sensitized to the revelation of her own real self. But it's not very likable. In fact, it's still intolerable. She now admits that even her love for her friends is selfish. It is erotic love. It's putting oneself in the center of things. Forcing her to confess, this dastard God that demands the life of Psyche, that demands and lives on human sacrifice, and yet it's only a stone that has no face, is this imperious harshness of the impersonal. Unget. I'm Unget. That's me. And now she sees that her kingdom is as a web, a spider's web. And she herself is the swollen spider, squat in its center, gorged with men's stolen lives. What a statement. Is that our biography? Or are there at least hints and glances of that in our biography? Lewis seems to think so about himself. And so later, lost within the labyrinth of her own darkened soul, because she's rejected every glimpse of another more lovely reality outside her, there's a time when she finds herself the prisoner, and is brought as a slave before the bar to look into the face of the judge and to see that's her. That's her as well. And so, in the impasse of her blindness and the frustration of self-knowledge that she has gained, she finds she cannot tell the truth about herself. And here, Lewis, of course, is showing how superb he is as a spiritual counselor, director. Why can't we tell the truth about ourselves? Well, because the persistent, lifelong inner murmur of spite, jealousy, prurience, greed, self-complacence simply will not go into words. True articulation of who we are is smothered in this darkness. And so the plight of the human spirit is to become who we are is smothered in this darkness. And so the plight of the human spirit is to become severely limited when it's no longer master of body and soul. And there's nowhere she can turn. The fox has guided her to cultivate her intelligence, but the intelligence is affected by the corruption of the spirit that has turned against God to itself. And so she observes that the fallen cooperate with new fantasies that possess it. And even the intuitive faculty becomes paranoid, while emotions refuse to harmonize with the Holy One. Fortunately, that's not the end of the novel. For in the conclusion, Oruel comes to a beautiful pool, where she finds herself in the presence of God, where she becomes clothed beautifully, and she hears her new name, and responding to the voice, she cries, "I ended my first book with the words no answer, because these were all the complaints of bitterness. But I now know, Lord, why you utter no answer. You yourself are the answer." One of the profound problems that we're facing today in our Christian faith and theological education is that truth is still impersonal. Truth is still objectified. Truth is still described, memorized, talked about, lectured about. But truth is the person of Jesus Christ. That he is the way, the truth, and the life. And without that, there is no truth. How much cleansing, then, of our inner being is required in this new paradigm, this new shift that we have to make? And when she is cleansed and has come into that presence, then she receives a face, real face. She becomes a real eye. Lewis might have added what one of our first students at Regent wrote when he first came here in the summer school of 1970. He says, "Glory be to God, he's transformed a lonely I into a glorious we." And the echo of his short poem has haunted me ever since with joy. Well, this is the kind of depth that we really have, I think, to communicate the realities of our faith. So, you see, for many of us, any progress now in the Christian life is a radical declaration of bankruptcy with the success of our Christian reputation. That's why one often finds today that it's those who've been divorced, it's those who have been, in every sense of the word, emotionally, morally bankrupt, they're the ones who are really going to lead us forward into the progress of the Christian life. It's really the recognition that Jesus always comes to publicans and sinners. And so the dilemma for many of us is we can't afford to grow in Christ because there's too much to lose in Christendom. We can't, as pastors or teachers or those who become conspicuous in Christian life, afford to let people see that we still have a veil. We're not like the Apostle Paul in 2 Corinthians 3, who could say, "And now without a veil, but with open face, we behold, as in a glass, the glory of the Lord." And are seeing that transformation from glory to glory. So, there is the task of North American Christianity today. The removal of the veil. And the recognition of how primordial, how profoundly shattering, how profoundly earth-shaking must be the reality of being a Christian. Well, we'll return in a few minutes to see perhaps more positive ways in which we can hope to see the cultivation of this.